Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the new novel, The Book of Collateral Damage, today's guest, Iraqi poet and author Sinan Antoun, tells the fictional story of a young Iraqi scholar hired by filmmakers to help document the devastation of the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. His journey takes him to a famous street lined with bookstores, where he meets a man trying to chronicle everything that was lost to war, from people to infrastructure to memories. Well, 16 years after the U.S. invasion, parts of Iraq are still in ruins. 1.8 million residents are internally displaced. According to the World Bank, the unemployment rate reached almost 10% in 2017 and 18, and almost 17% of the economically active population is underemployed. According to the Watson Institute at Brown University, 182,000 Iraqis have died from direct war, but an alternate analysis estimates the death toll at around 2.4 million deaths since the 2003 invasion. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about what life is like in Iraq today. Today, we're joined by Sinan Antoun, a poet, novelist, and translator. Sinan is also associate professor at New York University. He is the author of several books, including The Corpse Washer. His latest novel is The Book of Collateral Damage. And Sinan was in Iraq in February attending the Baghdad Book Fair. And he joins us from New York. Hi, Sinan. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. I want to start off by asking you about the very widely read New York Times op-ed that you wrote last year. It's called 15 Years Ago, America Destroyed My Country. And you write, no one knows for certain how many Iraqis have died as a result of the invasion. Some credible estimates put the number at more than a million. The invasion of Iraq is often spoken of in the U.S. as a, quote, blunder or even a colossal mistake. It was a crime, and those who perpetrated it are still at large. What was the reaction like to this piece, Sinan? I was just reading it again on the New York Times, and it got something like 1,500 comments.
Yes, I mean, I guess a lot of fellow citizens were happy that this piece was raising questions that should have been raised and should be raised every year. So the majority of the responses was positive, and it's sad that that this would be such a surprising issue. But I think it, you know, I mean, the piece tried to raise a number of issues, but the quote that you read particularly is that the way in which our society and the media and the political elite contribute to the amnesia, and this amnesia is very destructive because these very same characters go on to take us to new wars, and the citizenry is largely uncritical. So, and you know, just a few months ago, the anniversary of the invasion and the war passed, and there was nothing in the major outlets, in the New York Times. And these are outlets that participated in selling the war to the American people. So it's ultimately about accountability and about how our institutions are functioning or not functioning, meaning the media, meaning accountability of politicians. And I just want to tell you one story. We made a documentary back in 2003 called About Baghdad. And when we showed it around the country here in community centers and colleges and universities, oftentimes, you know, people in the audience would come up to me and my colleagues and say, you know, we're really upset about the war. What can we do? And my answer was back then, 2004, was that the next time the government comes and tells you X country has dangerous weapons and we have to go bomb them, just remember the Iraq scenario. And sadly, now in recent years or recent months with Iran, we're back in the same territory and the same narrative and the same dynamic is operative again, right?
Right.
The very same people and institutions that led us to war want to lead us again to war. And so that was one of the many reasons why I wrote the piece, but about the just to remind us of the human, the toll and the tragedy in Iraq, which the United States is implicated in, of course.
Right. Well, and the very people that are implicated, for example, George W. Bush in the piece you wrote last year said that you watched him on the Ellen DeGeneres show dancing, talking about his paintings. You just tweeted recently about how undergrads at Yale University presented George W. Bush with the 1968 BA with the Yale Undergrad Lifetime Achievement Award. I mean, this just happened.
Yes. I mean, we should all pause, even those who don't care as much about wars and about foreign countries. What does this say about our country? Because even domestically, George Bush's presidency was a disaster. But what does it say when a society, you know, there are societies that maybe do not hold their, war criminals to account, but you don't celebrate them like that, you know. Mm. People who perpetrated tragedies domestically and internationally, you know, go on to their private lives and are left alone. But here we're celebrating them. And also, I should say that everyone or many characters from the Bush entourage have the chutzpah a few months ago to say that actually they don't regret anything about the war. I think it was Ari Fleischer on Twitter a few months ago who said, that he has no regrets and it was the right thing to do. So this is the level of amnesia and revisionism that we're dealing with. And that applies to all other issues, I contend.
I also want to talk to you quickly about war crimes, Sinan, because with so much attention on Donald Trump, these issues are covered, but they just don't get the kind of coverage that you would expect. And so I just want to read part of a piece that it's actually quite shocking that this isn't getting more attention. I'm reading right now from Common Dreams. Representative Duncan Hunter, a Republican from California, has come under fire after admitting during a podcast interview that his Marine Corps unit, quote, killed probably hundreds of civilians, end quote, during the atrocity-laden First Battle of Fallujah in 2004. Duncan Hunter's comments came during an interview on Barstool Sports Zero Blog 30 podcast, in which he voiced support for Edward Gallagher, a decorated Navy SEAL facing trial for alleged war crimes, including shooting unarmed Iraqi civilians and stabbing a critically wounded prisoner of war to death. So here's Duncan Hunter, a congressman from California, who's basically saying that his unit probably killed hundreds of Iraqi civilians in 2004, and this barely makes headlines.
Yes, I think because he knows that this is not going to be an outrageous statement in today's United States. But this kind of statement and these actions are symptoms of something that is much larger and it's been going on for a very long time. So the question that we have to ask ourselves, how do we reach the point in a society where someone brags about, and he's not alone, there are a number of others, brags about killing innocent civilians? I think because a long process that has taken many years, and we can argue about when it started and whether it has to do with the roots of this country's national myth, but basically there is no distinction between civilians and non-civilians when these folks happen to be people of color abroad. In the discourse of Islamophobia in the post 9/11 atmosphere, but also it goes back to the first Gulf War in 1991, when the media and citizens celebrated bombing a country back to the pre-industrial age, and when on CNN Baghdad was being described that it lit up like a Christmas tree. And I was in Baghdad at the time in a basement, not knowing whether I'm going to live or not. And so the language that is used to describe war and to describe the killing of other people and the narratives that justify war end up dehumanizing others who are of different color, skin color or different ethnicity, so that we reach the point whereby all Iraqis are potentially terrorists. And you see that in culture out there. I mean, in films that celebrate killers like The American Sniper, or even in films that were considered anti-war films, so something like The Hurt Locker, which was celebrated as an anti-war film. If you look at that film critically, you realize that it's not an anti-war film, because it shows soldiers as victims, and all of the civilian Iraqis in the film at the end end up, even the little child ends up being a terrorist. So I'm trying to say that this is a culmination of many years in the making, and has to do with how Americans see themselves and what they do in the world, and especially when they go to the army abroad, and how wars, I mean, we're a society that's addicted to war, basically. And when it comes to Iraq, I mean, I'm sure most of your listeners know that since George Bush the father until today, every single American president has bombed Iraq. I mean, that says a lot about Iraq, but that says a lot about the United States. What is it that this country has to be bombed by every single president?
In the piece, Sinan, just to let people know a little bit more about your background, you write that when you were 12, Saddam Hussein was vice president of Iraq at the time and carried out a huge purge and officially usurped total power. You write, "I was living in Baghdad then, and I developed an intuitive, visceral hatred of the dictator early on. That feeling only intensified and matured as I did." And then you left Iraq a few months after the 1991 Gulf War and went to graduate school in the United States, where you've been ever since. Can you talk just a little bit about your childhood in Iraq when you were living in Baghdad? What are some of your some memories that really stand out for you?
I mean, look, this is it's always a problematic issue, because when people retroactively remember the years of dictatorship, especially after the country has been devastated by several wars, a lot of people fall into the trap of some kind of uncritical nostalgia. And the way the war was sold to the American people and to the world was that this binary, you know, Saddam is an evil dictator and we are the good guys and we're going to remove him. The problem was that Saddam Hussein was conflated with his regime, and the regime was conflated with the entire country. So to go back to my memories, of course, it was a dictatorship. And living under dictatorship means curtailed freedoms of speech and so on and so forth. But what I always highlight, not only to Americans, but to Iraqis of a younger generation who might not have lived or might not know that, and why do I highlight those memories? Because in 2003, it was not only the removal of a regime or a dictator, it was the destruction of an entire society. So the Iraq I lived in had a very excellent educational system, had free healthcare, and it was largely, and I don't want this to be misunderstood, a functioning society within the limits of what a dictatorship is like. I mean, there was there is an essay a few days ago, or just yesterday, in the New Yorker by a Bosnian writer who was trying to write about the Tito years of Yugoslavia and how to understand in a more critical way what life was like in Yugoslavia, so that people understand what has befallen the country. So, I mean, those are my memories, and of course, it's difficult not to hark back to the times that were good, and it's, you know, but it's always intertwined with bad memories, because in 1980 the war with Iran started and that changed everything.
Today we're speaking with Sinan Antoun, a poet, novelist, and translator. Sinan is also associate professor at New York University and is the author of several books, including The Corpse Washer. His latest novel is The Book of Collateral Damage. And Sinan was last in Iraq in February at the Baghdad Book Fair. If you have any questions or comments for Sinan, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about just the discussions we've been having, especially about war crimes, about what Duncan Hunter, a representative from California, recently said about his Marine Corps unit killing probably hundreds of civilians? And these kinds of things barely make headlines today. I mean, they're out there, but you have to search for them. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And what are your thoughts about just the anti-war movement in this country, the conversation about war in this country, and where it is today. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Sinan, you were last in Iraq in February at the Baghdad Book Festival. And I understand that you no longer have family in Iraq, but you have made a lot of friends on the streets. What was that experience like for you? What is Baghdad like today?
I mean, it's bittersweet for me because, once again, I lived in the city when it was a vibrant, safe city where one could walk around and where the infrastructure was functioning very well. And that began to deteriorate in 1991 with the bombing and then later with the sanctions. So going back, I try not to fall into the trap that a lot of returnees fall into by always comparing what exists now with what used to exist before. So I didn't have high expectations because, frankly, the entire city is so decrepit because of the corruption of the post-occupation regime. But it was bittersweet because I was being invited as a guest of honor to the Baghdad Book Fair. And I had a number of book signings, and a lot of readers came, and I met a lot of people also that I had, befriended over social media. So it was good to see Iraqis being able to go out, and it was after lifting the concrete blocks that had been put in Baghdad for such a long time because of suicide bombings and terrorism and all of that. So on the one hand, people have the freedom to move, and I got to go around the city and see what's happening and talk to people. But on the other hand, as I said, it's quite sad because the city is falling apart. The infrastructure is in disarray. There has not been, no reconstruction whatsoever. That's another issue that never gets talked about. Hmm. The great promises of the U.S. and the $80 billion that I think a congressional study concluded $80 billion had vanished between Iraq and Afghanistan through the corruption and the war profiteering. So the infrastructure is in disarray, but of course Iraqis, like other human beings everywhere, especially the younger generations, are hungry for life and they're trying to make the best of it. And of course, the encouraging thing for me was the large number of young people who were interested in buying books and in reading and in meeting authors as well.
Hmm. And Sinan, I understand that you saw a lot of young kids begging on the streets, and that's something you haven't seen before.
Well, I think, the cliche or the stereotype we see from, countries in the global south is that there are a lot of poor people and children begging. But in Iraq, what has increased is the number of children not going to school and the number of children begging on the street, not only in Baghdad, but I also drove to Basra and drove to Mosul, and almost at every stop there were children who were 5 or 7 selling coffee or tea or just begging. So the extent of the poverty in Iraq and the extent of the illiteracy in the country is something around 50%, which was not the case. Back in 1979, Iraq got a prize from UNICEF for almost eradicating illiteracy. So we have to also remember the kind of the degradation of Iraqi society throughout these wars from 1991 all the way until 2003 and afterwards.
Sinan, your last book, The Corpse Washer, was turned into a play, and I so wish that we could see this. I understand it just ended in April. Will it be extended, or will it be showing anywhere else?
Well, I mean, it was shown as part of this Humana Festival in Kentucky, but I'm in Louisville, Kentucky. It depends. If other, theaters are interested, it could move to New York or elsewhere. But it was adapted by two American playwrights, Naomi Wallace and Ismail Khaldi. And I managed to go attend one of the showing, and it was very powerful, and the response on the part of the audiences was also very positive. So I hope so. I hope more people get to see it.
Well, I think it's great that it actually played in Kentucky. I mean, that's a place that when we talk to people about plays, we don't hear Kentucky on a regular basis. It's pretty unusual.
Well, I think in Louisville, Louisville, but they have this really amazing festival there, an annual festival for new American plays. Hmm. And so it's very vibrant, and I encourage people to look at it to see the other types of plays that were included.
And in this book, The Corpse Watcher is about Jawad, and he has to decide whether he follows in his father's footsteps, washing the bodies of the dead, or pursues his dream of being an artist. And in your latest novel, Sinan, The Book of Collateral Damage, you write about a young scholar, Namir, and he is a scholar at Harvard. He's hired to help two filmmakers document the devastation of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. As a novelist, Sinan, can you just talk about the process involved in deciding what you're going to focus on and just your overall approach?
Yeah, I mean, often, at least in my experience, the novels start out with a kind of a kernel of a character or just a thought and an idea, and then I weave things around it. But I was always haunted by this notion of collateral damage, frankly. Meaning when I was in Iraq in 1991 and during the first Gulf War, you know, there was no electricity because of the bombing, and we only had the radio, and we were in the dark. And then when I left and came to the U.S. and I watched the footage, and I was shocked by the way, and that even, I mean, a lot of scholars of war and culture say that was a turning point in how war is represented also. That was the CNN moment. But I was shocked by the way the experience of civilians and the extent of the destruction that's brought about by war is completely erased. Mm. And it's all neatly put under this category called collateral damage, which makes the destruction of lives just an abstract notion. So this novel started out as the initial idea was that I would write about what is destroyed in just 1 minute, and it wouldn't be just a human perspective. Is that, you know, the objects that have memories in them, trees and animals and you know, the different forms of life. And then that developed into something more complicated, and that became the idea that, you know, an Iraqi American visits Baghdad and meets this strange bookseller who has this project of documenting war, but war from the perspective of its victims, not the victors. And it also, so it added many layers, you know, spontaneously. I didn't plan it, but it just grew out and became about also two perspectives. One is how one sees war when one is living in the war zone. Mm-hmm. So there is Wadud, who's living in Baghdad and who is himself in a way a victim of a previous war, and what it means to be an Iraqi American living in New York and watching his old country being destroyed through media, and also living in a society that's very apathetic and disinterested in what its army does abroad, and how one goes through daily life. And so it's also in a way a novel about the difficulty of writing a novel, because the Namir character is always wondering how can he start or where does he start from, whereas the bookseller in Baghdad has the opposite problem, in that because his project is about chronicling everything that is destroyed by war, he never really gets beyond the first minute. Because if you think of what one bomb destroys, it destroys an entire house. And if you want to describe everything in the house and everyone who lived in the house and all of the objects, so he realizes that his project is maybe a lifetime project that will never be finished. So we kind of have this contrast between someone who doesn't know how to begin and someone who doesn't know how to end. And there's also, you know, reflections about what memory is and what books do, how books can preserve life and preserve memory. But of course, I can't say it more eloquently than the novel itself. So,
well, it's a beautiful novel. It's called The Book of Collateral Damage. And today we're speaking with Sinan Antoun, an Iraqi poet and novelist. He's also associate professor at New York University. His last book, The Corpse Washer, was turned into a play. He also worked on a documentary in 2003 called About Baghdad. He was last in Iraq in February at the Baghdad Book Fair. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Tonight, we will be doing our last live taping about the connections between Japanese-American internment and civil liberties. It's part of HEAR, Histories of Exclusion and Resistance. If you are in the Bay Area, I hope you can join us for this free live event at 6 p.m. at Stage Works in San Francisco. You can find information at kalw.org. Tonight, we'll be talking about how organizers, lawyers, and activists are building solidarity across communities to protect civil rights and liberties in the face of Islamophobia, anti-immigrant rhetoric, and racial discrimination. I have to say, these shows have really been incredible. I've learned so much. We've had on amazing guests, so I hope you can join us for our last live show on this issue tonight at 6 p.m. at Stage Works, W-E-R-X, in San Francisco. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with Iraqi poet and novelist Sinan Antoun. Sinan is also associate professor at New York University. He's the author of several books, including The Corpse Washer, which has been turned into a play. His latest novel is The Book of Collateral Damage. Sinan was in Iraq in February at the Baghdad Book Festival. And you can find the op-ed that he wrote for The New York Times last year, which got a lot of attention, called 15 Years Ago, America Destroyed My Country. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to Nabil. Hi, Nabil. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Good. Thanks for calling.
Sinan, how are you? Good to join the conversation. Congratulations on the translation of your book. I want to start with some fragments of conversations that I hear on the street during my long walks in the semi-destroyed city. Today I heard like two men speaking to each other. One of them was saying his son died in a terror attack.
Nabil, we have a kind of a bad connection. Can you try to speak up a little bit?
Can you hear me?
Okay, that's better. Thank you.
Okay. I want to start with speaking some fragments of conversations that I hear on the street during my long walks in the city. Today I heard a man telling another man that his son died in a terror attack. I heard a policeman saying while I was walking on the riverbank where houses were emptied of their residents because of the conflicts and violence. It said 15 years ago, the policeman told me, 15 years ago, these houses were all occupied by normal families. They have all gone. And a child told me, Ammo, this is our neighbor's house. They have a long travel to America because of the war, of course. So Sinan spoke about amnesia. And blatantly, like everyone seems to rapidly heading to an illusion called normality and bright future when talking about Iraq, even Iraqi politicians in the Iraqi media, and omitting the sufferings of generations along the way. So I think the problem of an Iraqi...
Sorry, Nabil, we can't hear you now.
Can you hear me?
No. You're very low. Nabil, are you still there?
Is it better now?
No, sorry. Nabil, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Baghdad.
Okay. that's what I was guessing. Okay, I think we can hear you again. Go ahead.
Okay.
There, perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Are we good now?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, so speaking of this omission of Iraqi sufferings that has been rapidly going on in the media, whether in the United States or in Iraq, That's why I think it's a privilege as an Iraqi citizen to have an Iraqi writer like Sinan to document our losses and put them in poems or novels.
Thank you.
Because like everyone speaks about normalcy, but today, 16 years ago, like after the war, there are semi-daily attacks by IS remnants. There are people, civilians dying almost every day. We have flocks of homeless people begging on every intersection, on every street. But then you have the Oslo Coalition account on Twitter publishes some stories of
yes.
of families in Mosul receiving help from organizations funded by the U.S. government, but then no mention to or no real numbers of families that were entirely wiped out by the indiscriminate airstrikes that were carried out and during the battle with against IS. So this is today's Iraq.
Nabil, what message would you send to our listeners here in the United States about what's going on in Baghdad and as this administration just talks so freely about war?
Well, I would recommend that they read the book of Collateral Damage because there are many, many losses that they were like no one spoke about them before. And that's why this book is I consider it like as an important document that speaks for generations of Iraqis because it's they live in an illusion. I think that they have no idea that there are just normal people here who once lived an almost normal life, but then everything collapsed gradually until today.
Wow, well, thank you so much, Nabil, for calling us from Baghdad. And can we get your contact information?
Yes.
You know, Nabil, that would be great. If you can hold on, we'll have our producer, Laura Wenis, grab your information. You know, Sinan,
I was going to say that I'm very moved to hear. Nabil is one of the friends that I was mentioning in a way that we had some contact, but I met him for the first time when I was in Baghdad and he took me around in his car. We visited a number of places and streets, and we visited my high school. And Nabil is a very talented journalist. He's an engineer, but he's also a journalist. And I follow his tweets and his writings because he gives a very unique perspective on life in Baghdad. And I want to emphasize what he was saying about the happy stories that are put out there by the Twitter account of the coalition forces and by Al Hurra, this U.S. government-owned media outlet that only transmits in the Arab world because it's illegal for government propaganda to transmit in this country. But Nabil knows and loves the city of Baghdad, and you know his photographs and his insights about life in Baghdad. For average people, for the people who will live and for decades with the consequences of war and destruction in a way. So I'm really delighted that to hear his voice again, that he called the show from Baghdad, and I urge people to follow him, and actually I urge media outlets to speak to intelligent, eloquent writers like Nabil who live in Baghdad instead of always relying on the usual suspects, on journalists who might not know the city and the country very well and who might not have the critical insights and know the language and know the history. So I'm very happy to have him call the show because he's a very dear friend. And
Well, thank you so much, Nabil. If you're still listening, after the United States invaded Iraq, we did a weekly show called Open Line to Iraq, where we spoke with people on the ground to do exactly what Sinan just said, to talk with people there, not the so-called experts and pundits. We did that probably for a good year, and so we would love to have you on in the future, and thank you again for calling in. Sinan, how do you deal with this issue in your novel? Because before the show, we were talking about how people are just not humanized in the media. So how do you, I mean, people from the Middle East especially, how do you deal with that in your novels?
I mean, I should say that as much as, of course, I'm a U.S. citizen and I live here and I'm concerned with how things are represented here, but I wrote the novel initially in Arabic and it was translated into English. And I guess I just wanted to say that this is a work of fiction that's born out of my memories and my frustrations and my desires, but it's not to respond mm-hmm. necessarily to misrepresentations in the media. It's because I'm actually haunted by these characters and these figures, and I think it all depends on the writer's ideological position. I think even a poet or a novelist, if you are someone who is, I mean, the term humanist is problematic and whatever, but if you're a humanist who really believes that all people have equal rights in life and all human lives matter, then that will be something that will come out spontaneously in your art and in your writing. But if you are someone who holds on to some hierarchy of human worth, for whom some humans, whether depending on their class or their race or their religion, are somehow more important than other humans, then it will also come out in one's writing. So something that has been haunting to me is the hierarchy that a lot of human beings have, whether consciously or unconsciously, about who they consider a full human being and who is not a full human being. And there are many examples in the media, especially since we are in the media. For example, and I've written about this, when there is a terrorist attack in Paris or in Brussels, it's an attack against humanity. And rightly so. But when there is a terrorist attack in Istanbul or Baghdad or in Lahore, it's just a terrorist attack. So we have to also think about where we locate culture and civilization and how that is linked to certain humans and their culture are more precious than other humans. Why is it then when there is an attack on Paris, everyone changes their avatar and puts on the French flag, whatever, but an attack... So there are certain zones in the world that have been almost consigned to death and destruction. And then we come perhaps to this division of, you know, civilization and barbarism, you know, and I always think of ancient Rome. Or that's why one of the essays I wrote was called A Barbarian in Rome, because somehow the death of civilians in Yemen, in Somalia, by drones or by U.S. sold weapons to the Saudis and the Emiratis or in Pakistan doesn't really register as a loss of a human life. And frankly, also, let's think of it within this country, since we're talking about hierarchy, how the death, of course, of X person from a certain racial background is considered a tragedy and a horror, but the death of someone from another race is just considered normal. So to go back to what Nabil was saying, that's normalizing death and normalizing the killing of others is the problem. I mean, for me, I don't plan ahead. I just write, this is who I am in a way. So if it ends up humanizing, because I think of all humans as humans, I try. I really hope that I don't have that hierarchy of human worth. I think the way, I mean, one thing that's very important is how wars are framed and how, you know, and, you know, Judith Butler wrote about this, how certain lives are framed or certain lives we don't think of as being full lives. And hence, when they're lost, it's not such a big loss. So in a way, the way we view death is linked to the way we view life. Maybe I'm jumping around too much, but it's not about death and life, but about viewing life. I think after Katrina, right, the in New Orleans, some of the displaced African American citizens were in a stadium in Texas, I think, and when Barbara Bush visited them, she said, well, they're better off here than where they were living. And I think that's a very subtle, but that's a statement about how, for her, whatever lives they were living there, they're better off now. I mean, I'm shifting the subject, but also it's interesting that African Americans who were displaced by Katrina were called refugees, as if they're foreigners. You know, they're not even citizens. So I guess I'm trying to say it's mundane, but the type of language we use and the type of metaphors we use, the language we use to describe the lives of others, is this very same language that then allows us to not think or not really care much about the lives of those people.
Today we're speaking with Sinan Antoun, a poet, novelist, and translator. He's associate professor at New York University and is the author of several books. His latest novel is The Book of Collateral Damage. Sinan was in Iraq in February attending the Baghdad Book Festival. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's go to Kaveh in Oakland. Hi, Kaveh. Welcome to the show. Do we have Kaveh?
Thanks for this conversation. You touched upon the roots of this kind of casual conquest and subsequent amnesia. This is not uniquely American, but I often think we live on a relatively newly conquered American continent. The First Nations people who were similarly displaced and brutalized, and Rose, you can attest more to that in your program about the genocide of the First Nations people in Canada. Yesterday was on a similar subject. Slavery, Vietnam, the CIA coups in Iran and Latin America, the Japanese internment, et cetera, again and again, for economic, political, and racial reasons, others are labeled as threats worthy of subjugation and elimination, and later kind of forgotten about. It seems like it's a real challenge to get out of this cycle.
Thank you, Kaveh. What are your thoughts, Sinan?
No, I completely agree. I mean, that's why I said earlier that it has to do with the national myth. Definitely. I mean, it's also the way people conquer and kill others is related to how they see what kind of rights they have on this earth. And one moment has stayed with me for a very long time, in that in the first few days of the occupation of Iraq, one of the embedded journalists from CNN or one of the other organizations was embedded with an armored vehicle of U.S. soldiers, and they were leaving the camp to go out outside the camp to Baghdad. And one of the soldiers said, "This is Indian country." And to me, you know, I understand this, you know, these soldiers are themselves victims of socioeconomic system, whatever. But that was a moment when a journalist would take this and say, "What do you mean?" and use it as a moment of education. But that, to me, and so many other examples, are about how, of course, wars abroad are a continuation of the wars that began in this country. And it's about who has the right to the land. And it's about the, you know, the posture of the American white male. And to go back then to what you started the program with, all of these war criminals that are bragging about the number of civilians and the little girls that they shot in cold blood, this is a continuation of this idea of conquest, right? And so definitely, I mean, I think Kaveh is right, and it has to do with looking critically at the national myth and at this notion that America is a force for good. And sadly, you know, most politicians, of course, fall, you know, with very few exceptions. I mean, if you look at the last election, it's only Bernie Sanders who even met with Native American leaders, right, in the last presidential elections, and spoke about the suffering and acknowledged, you know, most other politicians don't think, because whether we like it or not, this is a settler colonial country. It was built on the idea of settler colonialism. And it's, you know, it's the devastation continues. And Native American writers and Native American poets and Native Americans attest to that. You know, there is an example. I mean, I'm a professor at a university. Hundreds of thousands of people have graduated with degrees and studied American literature. Did they ever read a poem by a Native American writer? It's only in recent years that that began to change. And so we go back to thinking, you know, who belongs and who's a relic and who's, who are the barbarians, distant barbarians and the barbarians amongst us. So I agree with Kaveh. It's not but what's unique to America is the degree to which this society is able to celebrate itself and pat itself on the back for doing good. You know, I think it was Toni Morrison or someone else. No, it's about this eternal optimism that some Americans have. And of course, certain people can be eternally optimistic. Of course, the really privileged rich folks whose wealth is expanding at the expense of the majority of us. So of course, they can always be optimistic because the law is on their side.
Sinan, we were talking earlier about your novel, The Corpse Washer, and how it got turned into a play and it was received very well in Louisville, Kentucky. Your latest novel, The Book of Collateral Damage, this has been translated. How do Americans respond to your novels about war and consequences through these characters like Namir, who he's the protagonist of your latest novel, and he starts his narrative with recollections of his trip to Iraq as a translator for a married couple. He writes about how, quote, nothing has managed to escape turning pale, end quote. And then Wadud, the character in your book who's working on the archive of loss, at one point scoffs at the idea that his project would take the word of a whole institution. He says, quote, oh man, you think we still have institutions here? So how do U.S. readers respond to these novels and these characters?
I mean, it depends. There are different types of readers. And of course, translated literature it has a very small margin in this country. You know, there are the readers who are interested in translated literature and world literature who are always looking out for works translated from other languages. And there are people who are interested in literature about war and about destruction. But I think there are a lot of citizens and readers who are thirsty for a different perspective, for something, you know, that gives you a panoramic view of other lives. And I think this one, those who have read it also have liked the fact that it links New York and Baghdad, and it links two worlds, and it shows the complexity and how we are intertwined. But also on a human level, it's because it's also about what war does to objects of memory, to animals, to trees, to plants. And so, I mean, in general, judging from the previous novel, The Corpse Washer, a lot of folks responded very well to it, and I'm constantly asked to talk through Skype to students because it's being taught a lot, but a lot of people read it, and I'm happy that after so many years it's still being read. So I guess we'll see. I don't have high hopes so that I don't get disappointed.
Well, and I also wanted to ask you, Sinan, I mean, you were so, you know, vehemently opposed to the invasion of Iraq. You've written essays about it. You've written books about it. I mean, 16 years on, sometimes I still can't believe it's been 16 years. What has changed for you over that time? As you've talked about the invasion, you visited Baghdad, you've written novels about the invasion.
You know, it's very sad and very tragic, but I guess a lot of human beings have gone through that. I hate to be one of those who says to brag and said I told you so, but you know, everything was so clear. So nothing has changed. What has changed is that I think and read about history of those who, what does it mean to watch a catastrophe about to unfold before you, and you know that what it's going to do, and no one listens to you. So, but I should say that it's not just about Iraq. I think it's about what kind of world are we making. Mm-hmm. What kind of atmosphere is this, where war is the default position, where the, you know, technological development and the wealth and taxpayers' money is all going towards glorifying and normalizing war and destruction. And it's not just in Iraq, of course. As we speak now, in the past years, what the U.S. and its allies have been doing to a country like Yemen. I mean, that is the country that rarely gets talked about or not sufficiently. It's U.S. weapons and U.S. logistical support and U.S. allies in the Emirates and in Saudi Arabia. These are the types of allies. So I watch in horror in this world that celebrates and glorifies war. And there are also effects domestically of all of this. I mean, if we look at how police brutality has increased and changed, and how because of 9/11 and the way finances are moving, you know, you look at U.S. police departments and they look like they're going to war against citizens. So I am horrified by all of this. And Iraq is, of course, a country where I lived for 23 years, and you know, it's my home country. But I look at this globally and it's very sad, and it's deteriorating. It's sadly, a lot of citizens, not a lot of citizens are asleep, because of course also a lot of people don't ever move unless it touches them personally. They just think that somehow they're going to survive alone. But whether it's war, whether it's climate change, you know, it's a time of solidarity and collectivity and realizing the commonalities and how we are all going to end up paying the price soon.
Sinan Antoun is a poet, novelist, and associate professor at New York University. His latest novel is The Book of Collateral Damage, and you can find more information about Sinan's work at yourcallradio.org. Sinan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.